Today, we're going to focus on the Korean War and Navy Air specifically and the men that made it happen. And our guest today to make that happen will be holder of the Medal of Honor from the Korean War, Captain Tom Huttner, Jr. Remember, the second half of the hour, we'll have author David Sears of the new book, Such Men as These, The Story of the Navy Pilots Who Flew in the Deadly Skies Over Korea. As a reminder to those live, now that we know the system's working, make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the show page with the usual suspects. And if you have any questions or observations you want to share, Eagle One will be writing Herd in the chat room, and he'll fold your contributions in as we go along. And now, for our first guest, Captain Thomas J. Huttner, Jr., United States Navy retired. Captain Huttner, welcome to Midraps.
Thank you. Good to be here, Cal.
Yes, sir, and thank you very much for your patience with our technical difficulties. As usual, at the last minute plus 15 seconds, everything worked out just fine. And we also have on our line now our co-host, Eagle One of the blog, Eagle Speak. Eagle One, how are we doing this afternoon?
I hope you can hear me.
Well, all is going well. Well, sir, first of all, Captain Huttner, I'd like to thank you very much for taking time this afternoon to come on here to talk about Navy Air's role in the Korean War and specifically the men who made it happen. It's another reason it's really nice to have you on. I'm still a young pup. You're roughly the same age as my father, and I've done a lot of talking with my father, and I know that you share with them in your generation is your timing was interesting, to say the least. You graduated from the Naval Academy in 1946, World War II, just got over with. And we used to run a little series on my home blog. We called it Retro Wednesday, where I was collecting some photographs of people who served between World War II and the Korean War. And if you could, and it's a story that's not really told enough, if you talk about what it was like to be a junior officer just as the military was winding down from World War II, but you're going through flight school, you're getting your wings, and you're trying to serve as best as you can as a young man that saw World War II come from beginning to end.
Well, when we graduated in 1946, World War II had been completed just about a year. And I think most of us who were in the Naval Academy at that time were anxiously looking forward to taking place in that war. And certainly we were so relieved that the war was over, but disappointed to the extent because we didn't have an opportunity to do our part at that time. We weren't quite sure what our purpose was going to be after that war was over. And the first duty I had was on board a cruiser out in the China Station, and there were evidence of the war almost every place we went ashore. When that ship came back to the States, I had orders waiting for me to go back out to Pearl Harbor. And while I was out there, I was an ensign, having just graduated a year before. And when I reported out to Pearl Harbor, there were three or four other ensigns whose category is pretty much the same as mine. But they were real tigers. They wanted to get into aviation so bad they could taste it, whereas I wasn't interested in aviation at that time. But when the Secretary of the Navy called for applications for flight training, these fellows persuaded me to do so, I have to admit, against my better judgment. But ironically, I was the first of the group to get orders to flight training, and I've never regretted for one moment my changing my mind as a result of the pressures on my old shipmates. So flight training for us started off in Pensacola. I reported in there in April of 1948 and then finished up in Corpus Christi, Texas in August after having gotten some pretty intensive training in trainer type aircraft and then operational airplanes. similar to the ones that they had in the fleet at the time. And it was just a terrific feeling to make that first solo and then to make the first carrier landings and finally to get designated a naval aviator to be a part of the greatest fleet the world has ever known.
When you qualified for carrier landings, that was before we had the angled deck as well. So you had that extra challenge of just having that traditional straight deck, didn't you?
Oh, it was a big difference, all the difference in the world. The World War II carriers and those that we still had in the fleet for about 7 or 8 years afterwards, we would land on a deck which hopefully catch a wire in the landing area back aft because they had aircraft parked up forward of the ship with what they call a barricade made up of steel cables so that if you didn't catch a wire for a respite, it was a very dangerous thing to land in those aircraft parked forward. It usually meant a couple of fatalities. But with the angled deck, which was an idea that the British had, instead of the landing area being parallel to the center line of the ship, it was angled off at 10 degrees to the left. So we didn't have to worry about the tragedy of landing and having our airplane get in the midst of the carrier's park forward. And it made all the difference in carrier aviation, much safer. We could handle bigger airplanes at faster speeds. And the landing accident rate went down precipitously after we had that innovation. Plus, what I must say was a tremendous amount of concentration on training. But it was an interesting time to be in naval aviation because so many changes were taking place after World War II.
Eagle One.
Well, Captain, you started off in the Corsairs after you got a flight school, and you were there for the transition from propeller airplanes to jets. What was the build-up career like? How did that go for you?
I'm sorry. What was what?
What was the build-up to the Korean War like for you? How did that do you?
Eagle One, you're breaking up. Let me see if I could paraphrase it a bit. What he was asking for is when your first operational aircraft was the iconic World War II aircraft, the Corsair, but you saw that transition from props and Corsairs into jets. And I think what he was trying to ask was, what was that the buildup and the change like as a pilot going from props to jets?
Well, it's quite a difference. The transition was actually much easier than you might imagine, but we had rather intensive training in going over from props to jets. But we had to get used to how much faster the jets were. Jets in many ways were easier to fly than the propeller airplanes because the propeller airplanes were subject to torque, what we call torque roll, and that's where the aircraft would act opposite the way the propeller was going, so that if you were fairly slow speed and applied power very fast, that propeller, the acceleration of that propeller could turn the whole aircraft around, which was dangerous at any time, but particularly if you were rather slow in approaching the ship and added a lot of power fast, that could roll the airplane around with fatal consequences. But it was a much different sensation because we were always flying at relatively high altitudes compared to the propeller planes before.
The plane you flew, the Corsair, when it first came out in World War II, it had quite the reputation as a killer because it was a challenge to fly. And I understand that the later versions with the better engines it was a little easier to fly. What was it about the Corsair compared to its contemporaries, either right at the end of the war or right afterwards, for the propeller-driven planes? What was so good about the Corsair that saw it ready for service and the important job that it did in the Korean War? And we even saw some Central American countries were still flying the Corsair into the 1980s. What was it about those final few versions of the Corsair that made it such a long-lived and effective aircraft?
Well, I had several models of the airplane, as you were alluding to, and the model that we flew, which was the 4 model, F4U4, had a, what they call an R2800 engine, and it was very reliable. It had had superchargers, so you could fly quite well at higher altitude. The airplane itself, the airframe, although originally designed to be a fighter, it was like most Navy aircraft today. It's over half a century later. It was a fighter attack airplane, and with the jets coming along, which we had a couple of early models in the Navy, but they could do the high altitude work, but they weren't nearly so good as a propeller airplane for bombing missions. And the Corsair was a great design for being able to carry rather heavy loads of bombs and rockets and guns. And it was just a good all-around airplane. It had a pretty bad reputation when it first came out, and it was rather dangerous on flying aboard the ship. And because of several of the undesirable characteristics, most of the aircraft went to the Marine Corps, and the Marines weren't hindered by in the landing phase, because they always landed ashore. But they made a couple of minor design changes, which made a great difference in the safety of the airplane trying to land it aboard ship.
I think we have my co-host, Eagle One, back up on the line. Eagle One, let's hope you have a good connection. Do you have a question?
Well, can you hear me?
You're breaking up quite a bit. It is, frankly, a little difficult to hear you.
Okay. Well, I apologize for that. Can you tell me about the situation with Ensign Brown when he first joined your squadron?
Yes. In 1947 or 48, President Truman signed a proclamation ordering integration of minorities in the Navy, which had never existed before. And when I went to my first squadron in 1948, I wasn't completely prepared for meeting Ensign Jesse Brown. I remember shortly after I got in the squadron, I was in the locker room putting on my flight gear, and in walked an African American whom I had only briefly heard of but wasn't prepared to meet him. But it was Jesse Brown, who had been in the squadron for about a year since he got his wings in Pensacola. And he introduced himself to me, was somewhat reluctant to do so, I think, because he didn't want me to feel that he was forcing himself on me for whatever reason it was. But he was probably a very friendly, quiet, unassuming, humorous, intelligent guy that I'd ever run into. He had been he was a good student in high school in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, which is where he grew up, and I think he was captain of his track team, but he's quite athletic and was able to go to Ohio State University. He had always said later on, or he did say that he had always wanted to fly, but never made any effort to get into the Navy's flight program because they weren't accepting blacks at that time. But when he got into Ohio State, he ran into an instructor who was also a naval officer and a naval aviator who liked Jesse and persuaded him to put in for flight training, which Jesse did and was accepted to be the first African-American naval aviator. So he came to the squadron with a very strong background. The squadron I was in was at Naval Air Station Quonset Point, Rhode Island, up on Narragansett Bay across from Newport. And they assigned him there so that he would be least subjected to any racial problems. And it turns out that even while he was there, although probably welcomed much more warmly than he would have been in certain places in the South, he was accepted in the community almost without question. But even there, he ran into problems of racism, which made it very difficult for him. It was so difficult for him going through flight training, the way he was treated by so many people, that he secretly married his childhood sweetheart, and not being an officer at the time he was going through flight training, he was not supposed to be married, but he married secretly, and had he been officially discovered, he would have been thrown out of the program right away. But even when he got up to Quonset Point, he ran into problems. He ended up living with his wife just outside the city of Providence, which is about 15 miles away from Quonset Point. But for the most part, he was treated very well. But the Navy tried to take care of him. And he was a good enough pilot so that he proved himself to be an asset to the squadron.
You and Ensign Brown and the rest of your squadron mates, where were y'all when you discovered that the Korean War had broken out? And for your deployment, were y'all deployed together? What was your workup like to get ready to go and to head west?
Well, the you might say the modus operandi of naval aviation is that the squadrons are permanently based ashore at some naval air station, which would be on the coast. But every year, the squadrons will go aboard an aircraft carrier, and they will deploy in the Atlantic to the Mediterranean, in the Pacific Fleet to the Far East. And during that deployment, they'd spend a lot of time, obviously, flying, practicing all sorts of missions they would run into during a wartime situation. But we deployed on the 1st of May of 1950 for routine deployment. And we were in Cannes, France, on the 25th of June when we heard that the North Koreans had attacked across the 38th parallel, had attacked South Korea. It was a complete surprise to us. One of the reasons was that in January of 1950, Secretary of State had made an announcement that North Korea was outside of our zone of interest, so that we weren't expecting an attack by North Korea. But we were very concerned about the unhappiness that was going on in that part of the world after World War II. And the communists were a great threat to us. So even though the planners may have been anticipating a war, we certainly had no idea we were going to have a war. But because of the training we were doing, as was our routine, peacetime routine, we were in better shape than any other aircraft carrier in the Atlantic Fleet. The Pacific Fleet didn't have enough carriers to really conduct a war in the Pacific. We had only 3 aircraft carriers, whereas as a matter of interest, we had, I think it's 90 aircraft carriers of all sorts at the end of World War II. But we were disarming so quickly in every respect that we just weren't ready for a war that turned out to be a rather lengthy one, 3 years.
Eagle One.
As I understand it, you were flying with Ensign Brown and some other members of your squadron over Korea, and he developed engine trouble and basically crash-landed. What happened after that? What was your thought after that?
Well, we've jumped quite a bit from the time of the start of the war to a time in December after we had gone through the Panama Canal and joined the Pacific Fleet. And we were conducting operations against the Chinese who had ended the war just after Thanksgiving of 1950. And it was up in the mountains of North Korea by what they call the Chosun Reservoir when he was shot down and landed on the side of a mountain there. We didn't think that he could have recovered from the crash, but he did. He recovered, but he didn't get out of the cockpit. There was smoke coming out from under the airplane, and I made a decision to make a crash landing beside his airplane to try to pull him out and await the helicopter, which we had called for, but it would be probably at least half hour before a helicopter could get there. So I landed as close to his plane as I could. I was okay, but when I got to his plane, I saw that he was pinned in the cockpit where the fuselage had buckled at the cockpit, so he couldn't get out. The helicopter came along in about a half an hour or so. There was about 2 feet of snow on the ground, and because of the snow and the configuration of the airplane, it was almost impossible for me to get any leverage. I tried getting Jesse out, the helicopter pilot. When he arrived, he tried to help, but there was no way that we could move Jesse at that time. Jesse was injured so badly, they questioned about how long he lasted, but the temperatures were 35 degrees below zero at night, and at that particular time it was probably about 0 to 5 degrees above zero. So we feel that Jesse expired not only from his injuries but from the terrible cold that we had to have up there.
I noticed when I was reading up on the occurrence that you made, I think, you know, a lot of times we say the old phrase, shipmate self in the Navy. And I always thought that the story of the effort of you, and I believe it was a Marine Corps helicopter, and the efforts they made to save your shipmate, Ensign Brown, is a prime example of that. And also when I was reading, I saw when President Truman gave you the Medal of Honor, and also when the USS Jesse L. Brown was commissioned, right there with you was his wife, Daisy. If you could for a minute, because obviously you had some contact with her, how was the support structure for her and how the Navy honored her husband and her not only by having her there for the ceremony, but also for the commissioning of the ship named after him?
Well, first of all, at the White House ceremony, which happened to be the Friday the 13th of April of 1951, she was there as for my being presented the medal by President Truman. She was there as a guest of the Navy. And when looking back on it now, especially thinking that this was only 4 months after her husband had been killed, it was a time of great jubilation for my family and friends, but she must have been just breaking apart inside. But she's always a very gracious woman, and gave all of us a very warm feeling that she was there. President Truman was very gracious too, and I think she went back to her home in Hattiesburg. She'd had one child, now she has that child had two children of her own, and she has several grandchildren now. But things were very different from what they had been 5 or 6 years and before that time.
Eagle One.
Captain, as you look back on your experiences in the Korean War and since then, what do you see as one of the biggest changes you've witnessed here in this country since that time we first got commissioned?
In the whole country? we're living in a very dangerous time. I think it certainly is as dangerous as it was in Europe leading up to that. I'm very concerned. We have a lot of people. There are people of countries all over the world who have benefited from our largesse, and ironically, a lot of them don't like us. And right now, ironically, the nation who was our big enemy at that time, that's North Korea. 60 years after that event and that war, North Korea is still one of our biggest threats, and we must be well prepared to go to war again. It's extremely expensive, and Navy is a very costly organization, but we can't possibly take the chance that we wouldn't be ready for a war of some sort. It's going to be very different from what most of us would imagine because of the wars we've seen through our lifetimes, but we have to be ready, and we need the best people we can have in our decision-making levels, because we have a lot of competition for the dollars to maintain a strong military.
Yes, I think that's one of the great cautious tales. You know, everybody thought of the great battle fleet from World War II, and you saw it in 3D at the personal level, where it just willowed down to almost a whisper of what it once was before your nation called you for Korea. And I was talking to my father a few months ago. So one of the amazing things is you look at North Korea now, and the Hermit Kingdom is still there, and it is exactly what you say is a threat. But when you look at South Korea, which before World War II, if you cut Korea in half, the northern part was the rich and the industrial, and the southern part was the relatively poorer and rural. And you look at South Korea today, and you have one of the most modern economies in the world. It's a representative republic whose economy is so strong that they even employ thousands of Americans, their companies do here in the U.S., and that would not have been able to have taken place without the sacrifice that you and your shipmates and the people of your generation did to give the South Koreans at least a chance to have the lifestyle that they have right now, which their brothers to the north can't even imagine. And I also would like to thank you, sir, for your service, and at a very small level, thank you for coming on Mid-Rets this afternoon and taking some time to share your story with us.
Well, thank you very much, Sal. I enjoyed it very much. I think it's a subject that the American people have to be aware of, the fragility of peace, and we have a very fragile peace now, and I'm delighted to be able to be with you this afternoon.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, and also wanted to remind everybody that if you are interested in seeing some more about Captain Hudner and his generation and what they did in Korea, again, on Wednesday will be a ceremony over at the Navy Memorial in Washington, D.C. to do that. And just as a reminder to everybody, you are listening to Navy Milblog Radio, Midrats. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander. And also I have my co-host, Eagle One of the blog Eagle Speak. And we're going to move on now to our second guest this afternoon. He is David Sears. He is the author of the new book, Such Men as These, The Story of the Navy Pilots Who Flew the Deadly Skies Over Korea, where you can read not only about Captain Hudner, but also other people of the generation and the things that they did, the aircraft that they flew. David, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, before we get into the nuts and bolts of the war, I found as the basis of your book, it was a very interesting concept that you came around it, where you, for lack of a better phrase, you stood on the shoulder of a giant and took some of his basic research and took it in another direction. If you could, take a minute and tell us how the book, Such Men as These, came together.
Well, it's, Such Men as These is the third naval history book I'd written, and the previous two had been about World War II. I'm of the baby boom generation, and probably the first American conflict that I had any knowledge of was the Korean War, and yet you could find so little about it. And I know as a child, one movie I was fascinated with was The Bridges of Tocco Rhee, the movie made out of the book by James Michener. And so I thought, in terms of writing a book about the Korean War, I wanted it to be about naval aviation, but I thought, well, let me see if I can find out the source material. Because I realized, even though it was fiction, that he'd been a reporter in Korea at that time, and see if I could track down the sources by looking both at his manuscripts and at his notes from the time. So I was able to acquire those. A lot of them are in the Library of Congress, and I spent a good deal of time going through his not only the manuscripts but through the notes, and working on my network of contacts in naval aviation to try to piece together some of the factual aspects of what he'd written.
Eagle One.
Hi, Mr. Sears.
Hi.
I've been reading your book and enjoying it immensely, and I'm a little jealous. My father was flying B-26s in Korea. And you're right, the story is not told of any of the flyers over there until you've written this book, which is quite a good book. Of the stories you have to tell in the book, did you acquire a favorite? Do you have a specific instance that you like most of the ones you wrote about?
Well, I know you've spoken with Tom Hudner, and his story in connection with the crash and the attempted rescue of Jesse Brown is certainly emblematic of that time for a number of reasons, because of the changes in the Navy with regard to race relations and kind of the definition of heroism crossing racial lines, frankly. I think also there are a couple instances in the book where I'm describing the what I would call two blind pilot incidents, one involving a carrier landing, the other a ground landing, where pilots who were literally blinded in combat were talked back by their wingmen into successful landings. I think that's those are kind of incredible stories, no matter what time or what war.
And when we were talking to Captain Hudner earlier, he mentioned something that I mentioned again towards the end, where before the Korean War there was that great post-World War II peace dividend. And when you read about the Korean War and it talks about the lack of preparedness to go to war, it's usually from an army-centric point of view. They talk about the initial forces that came on the ground from Japan had been doing occupation duty. They had bazookas that couldn't do anything against the T-34 from the front. And the training wasn't where it was. But we also saw the naval version of that where you talk about the Bridge of the Tokari, and of course that's the same thing that comes to mind as well. But they have the jets, the Navy's first jets there. But the truth is that it was a lot of the World War II equipment that really did the initial fighting. In your research and talking with the pilots, did you run into much of a discussion from them talking about the prop planes that they thought were old and useless, but when they actually got to the challenging theater area of Korea, they realized this can do things that the jets just cannot?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think once the aviation component of the war, and let's set aside the events in Mig Alley, but when you look at the ground war, the real needs were for close-in fire support for the troops and efforts to cut off the supply line of the North Koreans and Chinese communists. And ironically enough, the straight-wing prop planes like the Corsair and the new AD that was coming online then proved to be the best operational equipment for those assignments, and it was something not only the Navy was figuring out, but the Air Force, who was probably ahead of the Navy in its jet inventory, had to drop back and rely on P-51 Mustangs to do their ground level support. So it was definitely an understanding that when it came to the mission involved, that their prop planes still had some life in them.
Eagle One.
One of the fascinating parts of the book, from a personal perspective, was your discussion of the feelings of the pilots, sort of reluctance to go after troops in the open for a variety of reasons. Could you discuss that a little bit? Because I know, I'll say my personal reference is my dad talked about that when that was concerned to him, that sometimes those troops were dressed up as civilians and other things, and it caused
right.
a lot of consternation for the air crews.
Right. Well, I think I speak from the point of being a non-aviator myself, but I think a point of pride for military aviators is their ability to fly, their ability to take on tactics, difficult tactics, and the optimum is, if war should come, fighting one-on-one with another aircraft in the air. So that's their preference. When it comes to low-level ground support, you run a number of risks, and one of those is that you can end up shooting your own troops. Another, of course, is the issue of collateral damage, harming civilians. Now, in the case of Korea, this was especially so early in the war when there was so much cross-migration between North Korea and South Korea, and quite often civilians were interspersed with North Korean troops in disguise. So to be called on to strafe a road, say, always ran the risk of hurting civilians. And even as the war went on, strafing still is difficult when it's a machine against an individual. But the competitive advantage that the Chinese and North Koreans had was the number, literal number, the hordes of troops that they could send south. And the balancing act, in our case with fewer troops, was the ability to have complete control of the air, and that involved strafing. Always a difficult choice. A pilot would rather take on buildings or equipment or other aircraft as opposed to people on the ground.
You mentioned earlier about the, if you ignore the story of Mig Alley, and I always thought that the Air Force has done a great PR work from the Korean War, because that's all anybody thinks about are the Sabres versus the MiG-15, when the story is so much larger than that. But in your research and your discussions, how often, compared to their Air Force compatriots, did naval aviators come against communist aviation early on, middle of the war, or late in the war?
Well, I think it was mostly early on. Early on, naval aviation was really the only, they were the only ones from the American perspective, from a UN perspective, who were in the fight. And they pretty much took out the North Korean aircraft, Air Force, such as it was. But when it came to taking on swept wing jets, now the Navy had made a conscious choice because of their because of the limits of carrier aviation at that time, that they had to have, if they're going to have jet aircraft, they had to be straight winged and they had to be able to land on a carrier deck. Well, that made them competitively inferior to swept wing jets. So by and large, they tried to avoid, consciously avoid those confrontations. Although later in the war, as the task force drifted closer and closer to Soviet airspace, there were inevitably some confrontations, and I've dealt with a couple of those in the book. And often when they fought these, what were supposedly flown by North Koreans or Chinese, they were in truth flown by Russian pilots.
Eagle One.
Well, a lot of the missions that you describe, at least in the first half of the book, had to do with interdicting the logistics train of the North Koreans. And I was particularly taken with your discussion of the tunnel busting effort by the Navy. Could you describe that for the people who haven't read the book, so they can pique their interest and rush out and buy a copy?
Yeah. By all means, rush out and buy a copy. Navy pilots, both flying at night and during the day, came to realize that some of the most juicy targets, especially when it came to railroad rolling stock, were actually hiding themselves during the day in mountain tunnels, frankly, to avoid being strafed and blown up. So it became obvious that at least a portion of the resources should be directed at trying to take on these tunnels. And at least, I forget this particular squadron, but one squadron was particularly focused on that, looking for a technique to either fire rockets or drop bombs through skip bombing into these tunnels. And it was worked out as a tactic, primarily using the ADs because of their power and climbing capacity. I think, on balance, they realized that the risks associated with it weren't up to the results achieved, and ultimately they backed off of doing that. But at the time, it was quite a hairy tactic to pursue.
When people think of military helicopters, it's the Huey from the Vietnam era, but the Korean War was really the place where helicopters came into their fore. What was going into the war known the helicopters might be good for? As the conflict went forward, what were the real uses that they found for the helicopters, and how did that grow, especially in a Navy sense?
Yeah, it's really kind of interesting. I found a lot about that myself in doing my research. The helicopters developed with the Army Air Force and later the Air Force was kind of a tool without a mission. They went ahead with doing that, but didn't really have a mission for the helicopters to perform. I think the Navy realized fairly early on that they would be a good tool both for scouting and for at-sea rescue of pilots, so they were probably more aggressive initially than the Army Air Force or Air Force in developing helicopters. Now, the helicopters of that time were not very much. They didn't have much lifting capacity. They could barely hover at sea level, and when you got them up into the mountains, they could hardly hover at all. I know you talked with Tom Hudner about the attempted rescue of Jesse Brown, Well, the Marine pilot that flew his helicopter in there, I imagine the elevation was between 3,000 and 5,000 feet. He would probably not have been able to hover, and he really took a chance to just going into that to that level of elevation and hoping to operate as pilot, hoping to operate his helicopter. Now, as the war went on, you know, air sea rescue was the primary goal for the Navy. For the Marines and for the Army, it was spotting of artillery, coastal artillery.
Eagle One.
The other one of the other things I enjoyed about the book was reading about the dam busters, who took a slightly different approach than the Brits did in their dam busting in the River Valley. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I forget the time frame, but this was during a threatened communist offensive in the middle of Korea, and one tool that the communists had at their disposal was to control the waters of what was called the Hwachon Dam, probably still is called the Hwachon Dam, and they could release waters either to impede a UN counteroffensive or to clear the way for their own offensive. And it became obvious that something had to be done to remove control of these potential floodwaters. And a couple of efforts have been made, one involving high-level bombing, another involving an Army Ranger assault on the dam, neither of which worked out. And eventually a Navy AD squadron was sent in to bomb the face of the dam. And the CO of the squadron, who happened to be a World War II torpedo bomber veteran, realized that bombing itself wasn't going to take out this massive concrete dam, and he frankly thought of the idea of, well, why don't we see if we have some torpedoes on our ship and see if we can use those torpedoes to take out this dam, and in fact they did. Now, during World War II, the U.S. Navy was plagued with problems with its both with its torpedo bombers and with its torpedoes itself. But in the hold of this particular carrier, they did find some World War II era torpedoes. They ended up rigging them to ADs. They sent them up along with an escort, and they made runs on the face of the torpedo, not so much on the face of the dam, but on the gates of the dam, and actually were able to close those gates and to remove control of the waters from the North Koreans. It's kind of a retro use of a weapon that had troubles in an earlier war, but for this particular case, using the experience of this, you know, World War II combat-tested pilot, they were able to come up with a combat solution.
Another interesting story I saw is the story of Harry Ettinger in his POW line.
Right.
How did you come across that information, and what did you find surprising in your research on that?
Well, I'm not sure how I came across Harry Ettinger, but I did fairly early in the research. I knew that he was a night flying AD pilot. He was interestingly one of the pilots that entered the Navy near the end of the war. There was a big series of big confrontations over funding between the Air Force that wanted to build a huge bomber and the Navy that wanted to build a huge carrier. And actually, Harry, just starting out of his Navy career, was cut by the Navy, and he got a job as a flight instructor for a private commercial company. And he also worked as an assembler for this new Air Force bomber. It's kind of interesting. So at the time when the Korean War started up, he got recalled to duty, and he was actually flying his first night mission when he was shot down over North Korea. I think he estimated that he had 2 hours of combat flight time before he was shot down. he and his crewmen, there were two crewmen on the AD, bailed out. And as soon as he hit the ground, literally, he was captured by North Korean peasants, went through a horrible, horrible time under North Korean control, and later in the war was shifted over to Chinese communist hands. The treatment was somewhat better, although not in the best human terms. But at a time when the Chinese communists were using the POWs as pawns in the peace negotiations, and over a period of months, I think he was in prison for about 2 years, were trying over and over to get he and his cohorts to admit that they've been involved in biological warfare with weapons they carried on their planes. And Harry, along with a number of other people, a number of other prisoners, was able to resist their captors throughout this time. It was really quite a fascinating story.
Eagle One.
Yeah, at some point in the book, you kind of hit on the point that these pilots who had fought in World War II or who had been joined the military during World War II and hadn't yet got to fly, suddenly found themselves in a war that was different. In World War II, we had a distinct enemy we were trying to defeat completely, but the war in Korea was different than that, especially when the peace negotiation dance began. Could you talk a little bit about that and the psyche, effect on the psyche of the pilots?
Yeah, there was a big difference in that during World War II, the pilots would go for weeks on end without any action, and then there would be intense periods during an invasion or during a specific set of strikes against an island target where they'd be flying constantly. So it was intense combat and then long periods of rest and recuperation and training. But at the same time, they were in it for the duration. I mean, some were recycled home, but a lot of them stayed there for the duration. In Korea, you had the trade-off that the tours were relatively established at 6 to 7 months for both the carrier and the air group. But during that time, air combat, certainly air sorties, were kind of like shift work. They would fly routinely two times a day during the period of their deployment. They'd have brief R&R in Japan. But the level of exposure, especially when you're talking about flying against heavily protected ground targets day in and day out, was just amazing. That, how you keep it together when you know each day you're going to put your life on the line, not just once, but a couple of times a day for a period of 6 months. That's a real strain on anybody, even the pilots as well trained as they are.
A little more than a decade later, we found ourselves in a conflict in Asia again in Vietnam, and the Navy Air and the Air Force found itself right where it was in the beginning of the Korean War, that all the money that they were investing in new aircraft was not the aircraft they needed, i.e. for ground support. In the research you did on a lot of these guys that flew in Korea, how many of them did you find also went in and eventually combat missions in Vietnam?
Well, quite a few. One of the points I make in the book is that many of the aviators who joined the Navy either at the very end of World War II or after the war had ended did so through something called the Holloway Program. It was named after a senior Navy Admiral at the time, whose son actually served during the Korean War, James Holloway, who was the Chief of Naval Operations. But they went through the Holloway program, which was a combination of flight training and paid college education. And the concern at the time, this was right after World War II, was that, hey, these guys are going to go in, get their education, get their wings of gold, their aviators' wings, and they'll be gone. They'll be gone to greener pastures. That was a real contention over the development of the program. But as it turned out, I would say the vast majority of those people made the Navy and naval aviation a career. And certainly that was true of many of the pilots that, that served during the Korean War. They went on to, you know, serve certainly during Vietnam and in some cases even after. So it was a good, the Holloway program was a terrific investment for the country that was contested at the time.
Eagle One.
Yeah, I think at one point you discussed the fact that some of the reserves who got called up actually got pushed into battle before some of the regular forces at the start of the war. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was probably more true of the Army than it was of the Navy, but I think it applied to the Navy as well. The thinking was that with this conflict going on in Korea, there was a real concern that it was going to escalate into a much broader war. In calling up the reserves who end up being called up first and actually sent overseas were the ones that typically were not affiliated with a reserve unit. In other words, the ones who had the loosest affiliations with the military. They were the ones that were sent over first, guns put in their hands, and they were put on the line. Whereas the ones that had an affiliation, say a reserve squadron, the idea was to keep them training and send them over as a unit. And I think there was a big hue, and I know there was a big hue and cry about the injustice of that, but behind it there was a strategy involved, but that didn't totally eliminate the burden on some reservists who never expected to go back in the military after World War II. Most had reserve provisions in their enlistments, but once World War II was over, most never thought that would happen again.
David Sal, about a minute and a half left. If you could please tell our listeners what you'll be doing Wednesday over at the Navy Memorial for the 60th anniversary, and for those that were interested in getting your book, what would be the best way for them to do that?
Well, sure. This is an event, I believe it's an evening event that's meant to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the Korean War. Tom Hudner will be there. There'll be a showing, actually, of the Bridges of Toko Ri, and then a discussion and signing opportunity for my book. And I'd love to have people turn out for that. I think it'll be a great event and a great opportunity to talk about a conflict that meant a great deal to the country in the Cold War, but doesn't get near the recognition that World War II does.
Absolutely. And David, once again, thanks for having patience with our technical difficulties early and for coming on Mid-Rats this afternoon. Good luck with your book, and I hope we have a good crowd on Wednesday.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, David, and let me recommend your book to people who are looking for a good one to read.
Great. I appreciate it.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great Navy Day.
Adding the choice of a crispy chicken BLT to Wendy's 4-for-4 is the biggest thing since rappers trying to sing.
I got me a yacht and I sound like a robot.
But do you like the sound of this? Wendy's 4-for-4 now comes with a choice of a junior bacon cheeseburger or a crispy chicken BLT.
From Detroit to Macon, I keep it crisp like bacon.
Both are topped with crispy applewood smoked bacon and come with 4 nuggets, fries, and a Coke for just $4.
Oh, yeah.
At participating Wendy's for a limited time, meal includes small fries and a drink. Not valid in Alaska and Hawaii.
Are you getting enough out of your daily probiotics? With GNC, you will. Thanks to America's fastest-growing probiotic brand. Why is it number one? Maybe because GNC has guaranteed potency through its fresh buy date. 250% more live and active cultures compared to leading brands. And no need for refrigeration. Wondering what formula is best for you? Stop into your local GNC and talk with our experts. Just ask. We make it simple. GNC. See store for details.
Look, at Hardee's, we think that if you're hungry and you have $5, you deserve a satisfying meal. Like one of our new $5 All-Star Meals, loaded with American classics like a Charbroil double cheeseburger, hot dog, fries, drink, even a warm cookie. But hey, if that's not your thing, you can always break out your degree in menu engineering, piece something together from the other guy's value menu. Or just swing by Hardee's, get yourself a real meal. The $5 All-Star Meals. There's no better way to spend $5. Price and participation may vary. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Tax not included.
When we listen to the radio, we never agree on the station.
Classic rock.
Hip-hop. Pop.
Guys, quiet.
The one thing we do agree on, we all want an awesome free phone. That's why we switched to MetroPCS.
Stop by MetroPCS with the whole family and get four free phones of your choice from brands you love, like Samsung, Motorola, and LG when you switch. MetroPCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included in phone price. Free phone requires port. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network. See store for details and terms and conditions.